You're listening to this podcast, so that means you love reading and writing. Want to learn directly from best-selling authors like Brandon Sanderson, Soman Chainani, Shannon Messenger, and more? StoryCon is calling your name. StoryCon is a fun and exciting environment to learn firsthand from best-selling authors and make new friends along the way. Join us at the Salt Palace Convention Center in Salt Lake City on February 27th and 28th, 2026. Use the code MOLE10 to get 10% off your StoryCon adult track admission ticket. That's MULL10. We can't wait to see you there.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second. We don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
All right, today we are joined with Jennifer Nielsen. Jennifer, thanks for being here today.
Oh my gosh, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Brandon was super excited to have you on the podcast. Just a huge fan of you and your work and all that.
Yeah, it feels like an embarrassment of riches that I can get people like Jennifer. It's incredible.
The truth is, I probably had to pay a lot of money to get on this podcast.
Oh, come on.
So
come
well
on.
Worth it.
No, it's true.
Well worth it.
I felt really lucky. Yeah.
No, yeah, we really appreciate you being here. For those who don't know your work or familiar with your work, you write in young adult fantasy mainly. Is that correct?
I think I split a little bit between fantasy and then historical novels, mostly upper middle grade to a lower YA.
All right.
Sweet spot.
Tell me the difference between those two categories and kind of what drew you to those.
You know, I think that it's a difference in the way that we use creativity, right? So with fantasy, it's as big as you can imagine. And so anything that you can dream, you can put into that story. And with historical, you're dealing with a box. You have to work within the confines of the world as it was. And so they're two very different kinds of creativity, and they keep me balanced so that if I get a little burned out by having anything possible, then I get to shift into a confined world where it requires just a far different level of creativity.
I love that. It's almost like inhaling and exhaling with constraints, right? Like you have tons of constraints for the one, and then you can breathe out and enjoy the fantasy. That's great. Do you want to just take a moment and just kind of walk us through your backstory a little bit and what got you into writing, when you broke in, and just kind of take us through that story
a little bit of that. Yeah. So I think for me, I think I always was a writer. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that I ever believed that somebody like me could be an author, which is a career choice, because I never met an author. I never saw an author. I thought authors were super special people living super special lives, and I was not that person. And yet I loved to write. And eventually it occurred to me, I'd see the names on the covers of books, and I'd think, well, a real person had to write that. And it started to close the gap for me, this understanding that if it could be done, why couldn't it be me? And I do think the aspiration to become a published author requires this weird mix of arrogance and humility. You have to be arrogant enough to believe you could do it, and then humble enough to learn how.
Isn't that interesting? Like, I remember when I was a kid, when I looked at those names on the books, I just pictured a guy with huge sideburns who probably lived in a castle. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that's all I picture. I didn't picture a normal human. You know what I mean? And so, but I love that idea that, because I've noticed that too, that it takes this weird mix of being pushy enough to put your stuff out there,
yeah.
you know, and like saying, yeah, you should spend your time and money to read this thing I made up. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of a bold assertion. And then, but then also like to have something to back that up with, to have actual heart and talent so that there is something there when they see it. I mean, to me, it's almost like two different kinds of people.
It is. And somehow you have to be both simultaneously. Right. And to learn that balance, and if you come in too arrogant, the world will very quickly correct you.
Yeah, that's true.
So when was that moment when you realized, like, hey, I'm talented, I've got a shot, I'm going to start submitting things, and like we're going to give this a go. What was that for you when you realized that?
So I wrote manuscript one, mm-hmm. which was garbage, mm-hmm. completely unpublishable, and so I thought, okay, this is the humble time. And I wrote manuscript number two, and it was so much better, but it was still garbage. And then manuscript three, I sent it out a few places, and everywhere it was straight up no. Yeah. And then by manuscript four, I knew I was ready, and I knew this is the one I was going to break in with. And I sent out query after query after query, and I got back rejection after rejection after rejection. And I learned then, like, that's what it will do. This process of trying to become who you believe you can become is there will come a point when you have every reason to walk away. And nobody's going to blame you if you do. And you have to make the decision to stay anyway. Stay without evidence and stay without a yes on your side. And that, for me, is that turning point when I realized, if I never get a yes, I will still write.
That's awesome. And I'm sure you did have those days of like, this isn't going to work. Or were you a believer the whole time?
No. In fact, the way it worked for me is I had submitted queries to everyone with a pulse. And everyone with a pulse said no. And finally, it was down to one publisher left. So we're going to just let it be Publisher X. And yeah. Publisher X pretty much had a reputation of accepting everyone. So I knew I'd break in. It wasn't the way I wanted to break in, mm-hmm. but I knew I would. And so I sent off my query. And then fast forward 2 months, and it's the morning of my birthday. And on that morning, I got a phone call from my cousin. She had written one manuscript and sent in one query letter to Publisher X. They had just sent her an acceptance. And she was calling to say, isn't this great? We have an author in the family. And I was like, oh, that's so great. I just hate you.
Yeah. This is the worst birthday ever.
This is the worst.
That's so fun that your first try went so well.
I know. Isn't that great that you have all this talent and they just recognized it right away and I am a loser, capital L on my forehead, printed for the world. But at least I knew Publisher X was sending out their acceptance letters and I went out to the mailbox and sure enough, there's my letter from Publisher X. And I thought it would have been fun to be first, but I didn't care if we tied. That's cool. And I opened it up, and there from the publisher who accepts nearly everyone.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. My rejection on my birthday and after that call. And so, yeah, have there been times when I have lost faith in myself? Yeah, that day.
Yeah.
That day. And that's the moment when I decided this is it. I have all the evidence I would ever need from the universe that it is time to quit, that I have no talent and I have no future. And the thing I learned is I am a pro at failing. I can do that mm-hmm. every single day. I do not know how to quit. And that was my turnaround. And I threw out everything I thought I knew about writing. I started from step one. That is the day I learned how to write.
That's awesome. I like what you said earlier too, that even if you got rejected, you were going to continue to write. Right. And I think that's the mark of a writer is someone who writes, right? Whether or not you get published, if you're writing, you're a writer.
A writer.
Yeah.
I hit that point. I before I ever got published. You know what I mean? I hit a point where I was like, where I had to make that same decision. So it makes me wonder if a lot of people have to make that decision. But I made that decision of, okay, I might never sell a book. I might never be professionally, traditionally published or whatever. Would I write anyway? And then my answer was, yeah, it's like, what are you going to do? Watch TV, build model ships or something? Like, for me, this was the thing I was good at, the thing I was passionate about. So I was like, if all I ever do is write cool books for me that I share with some family members, yeah, I'll still try. You know, I'll do it on nights and weekends. Or I'll do it when I can. It'll be my hobby, you know.
Well, can I tell you just a slightly embarrassing story for you?
Okay.
That was really important to me. Very mildly embarrassing.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like,
I know, there's very little.
There's all of a sudden tension.
Embarrassing to you, like, yeah. Okay.
Slightly.
Brandon's shoulders are tensing up.
I'm bracing for it.
It's very mild, but it was important.
Yeah.
Shortly after Fable Haven came out, you visited my kid's school. And I happened to be dropping off my kid for kindergarten or something at the time you arrived. And you were running late to get there. And so you kind of, whoever was driving you, your wife or somebody was with you driving you, and kind of pulled over in front of the school, and you dashed out of the car in this mad sort of rush to get into the school on time. And I knew who you were, and I knew you were coming. And it was at that time when I was just believing I could do it, but I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And it was so real person. And that was so critical for me to see.
Oh, funny.
Because you launched onto the scene in such a big way, and here you were running late, and... Yeah.
You're like, if this idiot can do it,
well,
anybody
it was real person.
It was real person,
and I needed to see a human and not that person who's wearing the tweed jacket who lives in a castle and all of that, and it was really pivotal to me to say, okay, I could get there because you were real.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Like I tell people, like, look, I'm just kind of a big dumb guy, you know what I mean? Like, and that's in some ways that's how I come across a little bit. You know, I'm just kind of a big dumb guy. I'm not like super fancy or something, and so I'm good at coming across as real, I think, because I feel like I get to do something that I always dreamed I would get to do, and I thought probably wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and so I still have kind of an energy of, oh, this is still happening. You know what I mean? It's like always a relief, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like every book is a relief. Like, oh, this is still, there's still someone who cares. Okay, well, yeah, then let's do it, you know?
Then let's do it. I get it.
So, Jen, take us to the next step. What was the book that that people started to go, yeah, this is something that could work. Let's buy this.
Definitely, yeah. Take us through like your first yes.
The first yes.
Because we've heard the painful part.
We heard probably the worst no we've ever heard on the podcast.
Oh, no, it'll,
too.
You know, there's always going to be a one to top it, sadly. But no, I decided to write one more manuscript. And so I was learning how to write. And it was one, it just started, I was washing the dishes and I just heard this sentence in my head, you know, just like, only 6 children have ever read this book and lived to tell about it. And I had no idea what the story was, no idea of any of that, but I thought it was funny. Left the dishes. Frankly, they're probably still there. Uh-huh. And I went to write. And that became my first yes. And my first published series. In it, there were about, that was Elliot and the Goblin War, and there were about 5 people in the country who heard of it, and 4 of them were my mom.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was working on that, I started a new novel that I was certain would fail, because everything I had tried like it before that had failed. And so I did this new one in secret, and it wrote up very, very quickly. And then at the end of the project, I contacted my agent and I said, I would love you to look at this. And the day I sent it off, I said, I don't think this will ever sell. I told my husband, I don't think this will ever sell. It's very different. The main character is not always likable, kind of a brat. And if it sells, it will never be a big book. Mm-hmm. And that one was The False Prince, which has come to define my career.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So that was your second published, or the first was a series.
The first was a series, but okay. it was the start of a brand new
series.
This
is a second series.
But it changed everything in my career.
With these early manuscripts, how many of them were fantasy versus historical fiction?
The last 2 were fantasy. None of them were historical fiction. I wasn't writing it then.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, but it was the manuscript that ultimately failed, the one where I just hit that low. The reason it failed is because it had a side character who kept taking over all the scenes. Mm. And he was one of the big inspirations for Sage, the central character in The False Prince.
Okay.
Oh, so you kind of found that voice in that character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's do something where that's center stage.
Yeah, because, and that's why, I mean, he tanked that series. He wouldn't be a backup character.
Really so you've got, at this point in your story, you've got two fantasy series that are taking off. When did you make the switch over to jumping into historical fiction? And what was that first story where you're like, hey, I want to try something different?
All right. So I was finishing the False Prince series, and I was contracted for another fantasy series called Mark of the Thief. Now, Mark of the Thief is due in December, but this is late April, early May, and I wrote my agent, and I said, I have this idea for a Berlin Wall escape story. And I said, do you think Scholastic would buy it? And she said, no, they're going to tell you, go write Mark of the Thief. And I says, well, I will write Mark of the Thief, but I really am going to write this Berlin Wall escape story. I didn't know if I could. I'd never written a historical novel before, but I knew I had to write it. And she said, Scholastic will only deal with this if it is a finished manuscript. And so she said, if you want to sell this, you need to have a finished manuscript before Mark of the Thief in December. And I says, well, I really don't have till December because my editor is pregnant and she is due at the start of August. Then she goes on maternity leave. So if I have to have that done by the start of August. And my agent said, well, you don't actually have that long because Scholastic has a long approval period. So you need to actually have this done about a month earlier. And I said, well, I don't actually have that long because I need somebody else to read it because I've never done a historical novel before. And so I wrote this Berlin Wall escape story, researched it, outlined all of it in about 6 weeks.
Wow, that's really fast. Yeah,
it was insane. I don't think I showered a lot that 6 weeks.
Yeah, you were just lost in that process.
That's all I did. And I sent it off. And Scholastic wasn't, when they received it, they weren't entirely sure what to do with it. At the time, there was not a single other Berlin Wall story for middle grade readers. Yeah. And they thought, well, maybe kids aren't interested in the Berlin Wall. And I said, Death Strip. Just tell the kids there was a place called the Death Strip, and it was real, and it wasn't that long ago. And no, middle schoolers wouldn't care about something called the Death Strip. And they said...
You would think people who professionally market to kids that they would know...
Would see that potential.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's... I thought it would be more of a slam dunk, but for whatever reason, I think they were concerned about branding, mm-hmm. right? That you are a fantasy writer. That's the thing you do. And all of a sudden I'm like, maybe I'm also a historical writer. And that at the time just wasn't done, that you would jump genres. Yeah,
they kind of like to keep you in a box so that everyone knows where the food is on the shelf, right?
Exactly that. And they warned me, if we do that, they won't follow you. And I said, you know what, I can take this to another publisher. And they said, no, that's fine. We'll publish it, but you'll see, kids won't read it. And that book, A Night Divided, exploded onto the scene. And still is one of my top-selling novels. And 1 year later, Scholastic was saying, would you write other historicals for us? And so... False Prince really made my career. A Night Divided really defined who I would be as an author.
That's awesome. And do you publish mainly with Scholastic then? Is that your publisher? Okay, very good. Tell me, you mentioned the outlining for this historical fiction book. How does your outlining and prep for historical fiction differ from your outlining and brainstorming for fantasy?
Think of it this way. It's the way that you have to think. So in a fantasy novel, if I said you have 1,000 ways to get out of this room and you have to get out in 1 minute, do you have to, you know, you have a lot of options available to you, right? But if I said you have exactly 1 minute to get out of this room and there's no ways out, you have to employ a very different way that you think about the story. And so what I need to do is start by figuring out my parameters. What does that box look like? And that's just the timeline, the world as it was, the sequence of events as they were. And then I insert a fictional story into it. But really, how is that any different from a fantasy novel, Brandon? If you're writing, you build your world, you build your parameters, and you insert your story in it.
You still build parameters, but you have that godlike flexibility to establish whatever parameters make the most sense for your story, which isn't always the case with historical fiction, where there's certain hard, fast realities that you're probably trying to adhere to. So, you know, so at least there are parameters in fantasy, but those parameters are more flexible. There's more possibilities, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think the process as a whole isn't so different.
No. Yeah, you're still building a box that the characters have to stay inside of and try to work their way through, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, that's all it is, really.
Let's talk a little bit about the research involved, because I know Brandon mentions he does research for fantasy books, and you think, oh, what would there be to research and stuff? So tell me about researching for historical fiction, the type of stuff that you do there, the type of books that you have to read, and that versus the type of research you do for fantasy.
Brandon, I would love to start. Tell me about research for fantasy.
Yeah, so research for fantasy ends up being like, let's say I have a castle in my story. I need to know how castles are used and what the parts are. And so I will do some research on castles in general. So I'm not trying to invent what a castle is and how it's used in war when that's already been established a little bit, right? You don't have to reinvent the wheel for wheels that exist, right? And if you try to reinvent the wheel, you might end up looking foolish if you're like, well, that's not how a castle strategically would make sense, right? And so I will research weapons, and I'll research castles, and I'll research basically any of the elements in the story that are relevant to the story, right? Like if they're out in the wilderness and they need medicine, like I will research what are some of the real world possibilities for that, and then use that to move into creating fantasy possibilities. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
I just kind of want to know a little bit about what's already known before I stray into making new stuff, right?
Right.
And if I want to make that castle built in the sky, which I've done before, right?
You know, like, yeah, then you can break different rules,
yeah,
right?
I can break the rules and I can add fantasy to it, but it helps to know a little bit about, you know, what a castle is and what a crenellation is and what, you know, just what the parts are called, you know, like, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, so I do all of those same things with a historical world. What's the name of everything, and what would it be if you're lost in the woods? What's the medicine? Then add to it just the timeline of things, and then the actual historical people who were involved. So in March, I'll release Magnitude, which is about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. And so a lot of the things would be very similar to what you do if there was an earthquake in any situation.
Right.
But then I want to know, okay, well, the history of San Francisco and what was the reaction of the mayor and of the general who was stationed there at the Presidio, and the fires that launched, where did the fires spark and where did they spread and what's the timeline of their spread? And what was being done to combat it, and the consequences of all of that. And the research for that is the absolute most fun part of any project.
Yeah. Tell me about the limitation when it comes to historical fiction, where you want it to be in the world that we know, with an event that we're somewhat familiar with. But if you make your story that you're telling too big, it all of a sudden breaks history a little bit, right? So if you've got people who are escaping from the Berlin Wall and they assassinate somebody who was never assassinated, right? All of a sudden you've broken like history at that point. So do you enjoy that limitation? Do you feel like the stories have to be smaller because of that, because you can't go beyond, or do you do things in your historical fiction where it's like, yeah, now this person became president and that's the reality of this world we're in.
So is this question, do you rewrite history a little bit, or do you figure out how to
or do you keep the story small enough that it doesn't impact history?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Anybody who writes historical novels, you'll find the full spectrum of mm-hmm. ideology as to way the way it should be done. Some people will say it's historical fiction, and it's fiction for a reason. And so if I want to make that person president, it's fiction. Where I write for young people, I don't believe I have the right to do that because
that makes sense.
Will read it as if it's fact. And so everything that is factual in the world, I keep absolutely accurate. Like I did a novel, Resistance, which is the Jewish teenagers who fought back in the Holocaust. And that, to get the accuracy, I had a map of the Warsaw City ghetto, and then I used the Nazi satellite imagery to look at every single building in there, and I'd translate from the German to the English so that I knew the names of every building there. And then I found the sewer map below it. So if I say you could enter the sewers on this corner and this is your route to get out of the ghettos, that is absolutely, you could use it as a map and a guidebook to get out, because that is incumbent upon me if I'm going to write in history.
That's cool. So if we sent your book back in time, they would have had a cheat sheet on how to survive the Holocaust.
Well, it's what they actually did.
Yeah. I mean, that's really cool.
I was actually thinking the opposite of like five kids from modern day going to there and being, you know, crawling through the sewers and be like, yeah, she got it right. Here it is. Yep.
No, it is because, and the reason for something like that, and for really any big historical event, but if you take the Holocaust, for example, there are Holocaust deniers in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great
and
point.
And if I got one single fact wrong in that book, it allows that denier to say, well, she made this little thing up.
So everything could be made up.
Everything could be made up. And so I believe there's a responsibility if you write history to get it accurate, both for the kids who read it and for the people who would deny it ever happened.
So your protagonists, are they actual historical people in some cases, or are they usually fictional, completely fictional characters that you made up and put in the real world?
Yeah, I've only written one where it was a completely real person of history. That was an uprising. Everything else, I'll build the world, and there may be supporting characters who are real, but the protagonist is a fictional character. And you talked about the size of the story, right? And I think all stories, no matter how epic they are still small stories. I mean, if you take Lord of the Rings and all of its mass and volume, at the end of the day, it's about a hobbit mm-hmm. who has a task he really, really does not want to carry out, but he's agreed to do it. And so it doesn't matter how big the scale, it's still the story of Frodo Baggins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
The story is found in the character and what matters to them. Right? Like that, that's where we find the story. And that can, the scale can be, the stakes could be the world, or the mm-hmm. stakes could be, is Rudy going to get a play in a Notre Dame football game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And as long as the character cares enough, the reader can get on board and go, yeah, I care too, you know?
Yeah.
And so for Scholastic, do you have to keep your protagonist at a young age then? Or are you writing historical fiction about adults?
No, I tend to write with a young protagonist because I believe that for middle grade kids in the fourth through eighth grade, there's something about their brain that makes them unique from the way that anybody else thinks. And it's the way that they process the stories they read. And so we might read Harry Potter, and we always know that we're reading about Harry Potter. And the middle grade student knows it too, but they read it differently. Their brain, it lights up two different parts of the brain, and it lights up the sensory motor, which is the motion part of the brain, with the language receptors of the brain, and it mixes the two. So a middle grade brain processes the story as if it were them. And so the kid who reads about Kendra, she is processing it as if she had lived. The brain is processing it.
Yeah.
And so I write about young people so that they can walk into the story and believe that they have the power to impact their futures. They have the power to have a voice to make a difference. And so it's not mandated to me by Scholastic. It's just why I choose it. because I think it has the greatest impact on who a young person, how they view themselves as they read.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think I still have middle grade brain. because when I read, I always process like it's me.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I still, like to this day, like it's one of the things I most like about a book. Because I feel like when I read a book, I feel like I put it on. I feel like I'm stepping into VR goggles and mm-hmm. becoming a character. And this comes to life in my head and I go live this experience. And so it's almost like I have to be careful what I read a little bit. You know what I mean? Because I do go live it. Like it's really kind of thrilling, but it makes me wonder about my brain. Because I was like that as a kid, but I really am still kind of like that. That's true.
I think that's an amazing trait to have been able to hold on to that.
Yeah, maybe it's part of why I do what I do. Maybe. You know what I mean? Or maybe, you know, this makes me wonder, maybe because I've always liked to make up stories in this way, maybe that faculty just kind of locked in at that age and just stayed because I never left it. Does that make sense? Like maybe it did.
If that's true, that's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, no, I like awesome. It. I like it.
Well, I know criticism isn't our favorite topic, and you probably are both wise and don't seek out critics of your book. But
right.
But tell me, when it comes to historical fiction, it seems like you're inviting a whole new group of critics who don't care about the plot, don't care about the story. They care that you got something factually wrong about the world. Are you seeing that group, or are you just good at just avoiding all that altogether?
You know, it's fine when it happens. My favorite though is when it is a young person, because the facts they will collect about historical information, the minutiae is staggering. And so they'll, you know, like I did Iceberg about the Titanic, and some kid will raise their hand and like, Mrs. Nielsen, you had the wrong number of rivets on the boat, the correct number of rivets. And I don't even know, but I guarantee there is a 13-year-old out there who knows how many rivets were in each single section of it. And yeah. They are passionate about it.
I was that guy's roommate in college. That's true. He had multiple Titanic books in his library, his personal library. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? How great is that? If I'm going to get criticism from a kid because they have studied something so intensely.
Oh, it's awesome.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah. It is the best. But yeah, they'll criticize the Resistance cover because they'll be like, is that the, you know, which bomber is that flying over the ghetto in that photo? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't even draw it. And they're like, well, it better not be this model, because in 1938, Germany only made 38 of those, you know, airplanes and bombers. And so it couldn't be that one. I'm like, well, then let's just say it's not.
Yeah, it's probably not. Yeah.
It's probably not that one.
That's funny. So do you do a lot of school tours then now? You're mm-hmm. running late to those like Brandon did back in the day? And
constantly.
Tell me about your experience with the school tours and just seeing the kids react to your books and what that means to you.
This is the way I'm going to put it, and it may resonate with some more than others, but this is what it is. When I do school visits, I feel like I have this agreement with God, and the agreement is He doesn't care about my books. He doesn't care if I write about this or this or this, but He does care a great deal about who my books give me access to. And Jewel Parker Rhodes is an author. She calls any interaction with a young reader, she calls it sacred space. And I do believe in that, and not in a religious way, but that you have this moment where you are the author and somebody is coming to you, a young writer who wants advice, or somebody who read your book, or they're a fan, or they don't think they like reading, and they are stuck there watching you, and you have this moment and this opportunity, and you can use it or you can waste it. But because of this agreement, I don't feel like I'm allowed to waste it. And with that in mind, I have seen the most incredible things happen in school visits where I know I was supposed to be there that day.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that.
That's really cool. I had this experience. I'll tell you something that I don't always talk about. Where, you know, as I was going through my divorce, I had a real come to God moment for myself, where I'd always been kind of a religious person, but I felt some divine help as I was going through something that was extraordinarily painful. And I felt so much help that for me, the reality of God was more deeply impressed upon me because he gave me help such that for me, from my point of view, I was not in a mood to pretend. And I felt like the help was very real and very personal. And it left me different after that experience. I was never the same guy. If there's such a thing as a born-again experience, that might have been mine, right? Like, was the help I got as I went through my divorce. And I'm not going to try to tell that whole story. But what I will tell you is this. Almost everything in my life after that moment felt different. The way I interacted with the world felt different. But when I did book signings, it was like the one thing that felt the same. And it was kind of like, I felt like God was saying, you actually did this one part right. like this one part where you were nice to kids who came and read your books. He's like, that part you were doing right. Keep doing that the same way. And what I was doing there was just, you know, you've always heard never meet your heroes. And for some of these kids, they really like the books. And I kind of move into that hero space for a certain kid on a certain day, right? And it's kind of like what you were saying, right? This sacred space mm-hmm. where they're really looking to you. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to wreck that moment for anybody, right? Like I would be so excited to meet Tolkien or so right. excited to meet C.S. Lewis. And there was so much I would want from that encounter. And I try to give that, if that makes sense, just a little bit of like genuine being interested in the person, a little bit of like trying to be, just trying to not mess it up, basically. You know what I mean? Just like make sure every time you interact with a kid, give them attention, give them a moment of time, actually listen to them, actually ask them something and respond to what they want to know and do it kindly. And that's it. But it's like if you do that, like wash, rinse, repeat, over time, you end up with 20-somethings in your line who come up and say, I read books because of you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like, yeah, that kills me.
I think all of that, that you have this moment and you can only do what you can do. And for most kids, that's enough. There are times, like I remember one being in a school and there was a lunch with the author. And so we had about 30 minutes in the library before any kids were going to come in. But when I walked in, here's this eighth grade girl already in there. And I thought that was odd because she should be in class, but none of the adults seemed to be bothered by the fact that this one kid is... Yeah.
She'd like slip through the cracks.
And nobody cares. Nobody cares. She's just there. Well, she's my person. So I went over to talk to her and at first it's just one word grunts. And I thought, you think you're the first, you know, eighth grader I've had to talk to. And so I kept, you know, just talking and joking with her. And pretty soon there were one, you know, like it was a full sentence. And then we were talking, and then she was smiling and laughing. And we had about 20 minutes, just us. And then the other kids started to arrive, and the librarian ushered us in. But right before, she pulled me aside as this girl went in, and she just gave me this hug. And she said, you have no idea. And I was like, well, that's true. I literally have no idea.
Yeah.
And she said, last spring, this was a fall visit, she said, last spring, that girl was in here every single day because the thing that she and her mom did is they'd just read a book every single day that she'd come in to get something new. And she said, her mom died over the summer. And I have not seen that girl in my library since. And the only reason she came today is because she and her mom had loved The False Prince.
Oh, gosh.
And she felt like she owed it to her mom to be there. And I'm not going to pretend, right, that like, that one interaction healed that trauma mm-hmm. because of course it didn't. But for that one moment in time, that 20 minutes, she got to be around books and smile and think about and talk about story and what it meant to her. And that is what I say is that sacred space.
Yeah. No.
Well, and you're not saying it, but I'll say it. Like you did something beautiful. Mm-hmm. You did something that was so right. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That really did matter for that girl. And, you know, you might not want to say that, but, like, it's it's so apparent. It just resonates through the whole story. Yeah. And, like, how beautiful to be in that position and to do your best to not drop the ball, right?
Yeah.
Like you can look back on that as, like, as like a beautiful achievement, like among any of the other achievements you ever do.
You also had the power to do a lot of damage in that moment, not knowing it either, right? If you were tired, if you were exhausted, if you're just like, oh my gosh, one kid in here, and just give me my space, and I'll talk to you when everybody else is there.
Which could have been reasonable.
Yeah.
It's human and it happens. But that's what I say by, you know, I respect the space that I'm given. And it doesn't mean I handle it perfectly or right all the time. I have made my mistakes on that where I drive away and think I missed a moment. Yeah. But I go into it very intentionally. And whatever else happens in a school visit, I always know I'm there for somebody.
Yeah, I love it. I also love how you mentioned earlier how much care you put into how you're writing for these kids as well, knowing that they see themselves in it. And so to know that you put that type of care in your writing and then later in your visits, I think that's the complete package, right? That's really showing these kids.
Yeah, those two things together are really powerful. It lets you – have you ever seen the – there's like this old sort of like semi-animated thing, The Man Who Planted Trees?
Mm.
Have you ever seen that thing? There was this, you know, it's from a story, but it's just this story about this kind of older middle-aged guy that lives out in the French countryside or someplace. I think it was French, I don't know. But he plants 100 trees a day, right? He just goes around and he pokes holes in the ground, gets the right seeds, does it carefully, does it right, and plants 100 seeds a day. And it's about how, like, by the end of this guy's lifetime, he's created forests that have altered the landscape of the world.
Wow.
You know, and like the in that role of writing books and then going and being kind in school visits, I find that analogy useful to be like, little by little, you can plant seeds that gradually make a difference or a shift and increase literacy or increase, you know what I mean? Like there's some real power in doing that consistently over a long period.
Well, I think if you project it forward. You have people listening who are wondering, do I have a future as an author? Will my stories ever matter? Will it make any difference? Will I ever make it? And if you knew that your story was going to change somebody's life one day, would you keep on writing? And you and I, we have the benefit of having these stories and these experiences. But if I had known while I was in that failure stage that I would have some of these moments ahead of me, the failure stage would never have mattered. It would be just, hey, I know where I'm headed. Just keep going.
And it's useful to note that we could not see any of these experiences from the position of that failure stage.
No.
You know what I mean? Like they come along as surprises. And there's probably many I don't know about. But just from the ones I do know about, I could have never predicted some of the ways that things have mattered to people. You know, because we're making up stories and you just think I'm making up a story sometimes, you know, and you don't realize that, oh, someday there might be a kid who's sick, who that story was a distraction for them when they were sick. And then they tell you about it and you're like, I never thought about that. But that's really cool that happened. You know what I mean? And like, or like you said, like a girl whose mom died and she had really bonded with her mom through these books and she was able to have an experience with you that brought that back to her. You know what I mean? You can't look ahead and see it. And so you partly just go forward on faith. You know what I mean? Trusting that if I keep doing this and if I make cool stuff and if I put goodness out into the world, over time that'll matter.
Well, in every book ever published is somebody's favorite. So whether you sell a million copies or whether you sell a couple of copies, somebody will read it and say, that is the book that changed my life.
That's awesome. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for being on this episode today. This was a special episode for Brandon and I. This was this marks the end of our second year of recording Mulling It Over, and what a treat to have you on this episode. You're an amazing storyteller, thanks for sharing those wonderful stories today. We have you for a couple more months. So if you're listening to this podcast, get excited because we've got a couple more months with Jennifer. Before we close, do you have anything that you want to plug, any books that are coming out soon or that have recently released that that we should be aware of?
Well, I want to congratulate you on your 2 years.
You.
That's a very big deal. Just out this past October is the Free State of Jax, which again is another jump in new genre for me. And I hope it's one that if you haven't got it already, I hope you'll check it out. It is laugh out loud funny until you just start to really feel for this kid.
What's the basic premise? What's the basic?
Jax is on the night before his 12th birthday. He sneaks out from his aunt and uncle's home, who are just worse than the Herdmans, if you know that family. And from Best Christmas Pageant Ever.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And anyway, he launches a raft at the neighboring house backyard and raises a flag, declares his raft the Free State of Jax, his own micronation. And Jax is about to declare his freedom, that he is free and independent and can do as he wishes with his life.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's great.
Really fun.
That is fun. Brandon, do you have anything coming up that you want to tell us about?
We're looking ahead to the Guardians series, which will be out in April, which is a big new series for me. And we're looking, you know, backwards. We did a Tales of Nulandorin, you know, about the Fablehaven satyrs. That turned out fun and funny. So, like, kind of sandwiching Tales of Nulandorin is fun and funny and short. Guardians is about as thick and mighty as I write them. So.
Is this your longest book that you've done, or some of your climaxes been longer, like book fives? And
it's my longest book one by a good margin. Yeah. It might not be as long as some of my book fives. But
okay.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, that's enough for now.
Can't wait.
Well, great. Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Jennifer.